From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a Stockton man who's forming an armed militia because of upcoming cuts in the police department. Plus, classical pianist Richard Chanko in concert this weekend. And more sound advice, our regular Thursday feature, this week alternative rock with off-air host Nick Bruner. But first, what should you do if faced with a mountain lion? A new study suggests you might want to run. Joining us in our studio is the UC Davis researcher who worked on this. He's Richard Koss. Richard, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on the program.
California Fish and Game says, if you encounter a mountain lion, do not run. But your study finds that you might want to run. How could that be?
It depends on the circumstances. And what we did in our studies, we looked at all the different kind of situations, like people moving rapidly, or they weren't moving rapidly, or standing still, and looking at the likelihood of them being injured or killed or severely injured or lightly injured. And so in these circumstances, we found that half the people that ran actually escaped injury. We're only like around 26% that ran escaped injury if they stood still.
Did that surprise you?
It did. We were expecting it just the other way around. And so it was. That's why it was kind of intriguing to sort of see that outcome.
What was the response of people that you presumably consulted who do advise you to not run?
Well, I mean, some of those people were on the study itself, so they were kind of surprised by the outcome as well. But we looked at the numbers in a larger scale, you know, with 185 attacks, and these were committed mountain lions. They were going to attack. And in that sense, it was kind of different than just looking at all the circumstances where a mountain lion may sort of walk into view and people look at it and then they report it, but they, you know, they don't necessarily hurt by it and you can't really make sense of what it is. Here we have motivated animals.
The fact is a mountain lion can run a lot faster than a human. How can we outrun a mountain lion, or is that not what it's about?
I don't think that's quite what it's about. It's very contextual. I think that if a mountain lion were approaching in a menacing way at a distance, what you might want to do is to make judgments about where you are. Is there a likelihood you could sort of run smoothly? And part of that's because the mountain lion will look for any kind of unsteady gait that might suggest you're injured. And if you're standing there inept and the animal's coming towards you, I think that suggests that you're probably not very aware of it or you've got some other physical problems. Whereas if you have a close-range encounter, then you have a different situation because clearly the mountain lion could overtake you.
But the mountain lion presumably attacks with just a split second's warning, at least in some cases, many cases.
In some cases, then you're in trouble. Yes, you'd have to defend yourself.
I see. But that doesn't give you very much time to look around, determine what kind of terrain there is.
That's right. Absolutely. You're going to be really confronted by something. You have to make very quick decisions, and probably you're going to revert to a lot of very primitive behavior, which is really trying to picking up stuff. You know, people have actually done remarkable things like picking up sticks and just clubbing the mountain lion. And it's just, there's no thinking there. It's just an automatic kind of mobbing behavior. And we know that people have this natural ability to use clubs, and they can do it effectively.
My guest is Richard Koss, psychology professor at UC Davis and lead author of a recent study into how humans should respond when faced with a mountain lion. Also with us is Sean Smallwood. He's an ecologist. He's been on Insight before on an unrelated matter, and he has encountered a mountain lion. Sean, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about your experience of meeting a mountain lion.
Well, it happened in 1985. It was the day after my first statewide track count. Which I initiated then, I still do it today for mountain lions. And it was just coincidental. It was the day after the track count. I was really tired. I went for a hike. I had to relax on Goat Mountain, Lake County, California. About 10 o'clock in the morning, I got tired, laid down by a creek on the slope. I fell asleep for about 20 minutes, and I woke up with the hair on the back of my neck standing up and on my arms. I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what, but I lifted my eyes and looked across the creek, and I could see a large male mountain lion. I could tell it was male by its size. It was moving down the slope on dry oak leaves and needles, pine needles, without making a sound. So I mean, I suspect I probably smelled it, but I'm not sure. It went down to the creek, and I thought it didn't see me. It never looked my way, so I picked up my Instamatic camera and took about 10 steps forward, hoping to get a picture of it as it emerged from the creek. It did emerge from the creek. I got a picture, but it still didn't look my way. I'm going behind a copse of trees. And then I moved a couple more paces forward, and to my surprise, I caught it looking at me from the other side of the copse of trees to my right. So it had must have run around the trees and positioned itself to my right. It was now about 30 yards away and staring at me. So I stopped and stared at it. I had just helped Lee Fitzhugh, one of the co-authors of Dick Koss's study. I had helped him gather a lot of the data that they actually used in this paper as a volunteer, and I was an undergraduate at the time when I collected these data. So I was pretty familiar with the stories about mountain lion attacks and what you should do. to avoid it, and I knew that I should stand still based on what I had read. So I stood still, and the mountain lion just stared at me for 5 minutes. Then I tried various things that Lee Fitzhugh had recommended to Department of Fish and Game, like waving your arms, yelling, talking. I tried all those things. I tried jumping up and down. The mountain lion just simply stared at me. It didn't change its stance one bit. So finally, I found panic overtaking me, and I turned my back to run. And when I did that, I kept my eyes on it, and the mountain lion it quickly went into an attack posture. It went on, it put its head on its forepaws.
When you turned to start running, it moved into attack posture.
It did. His ears went back, eyes went big, his tail went up, and the tip of the tail started twitching. I knew that if I ran, it was going to pounce on me. So I stopped and faced it again. After a few seconds, it calmed down and stood back up. And then I slowly backed up to a bow and arrow I'd left 10 paces back. I picked up the bow and arrow, and I tried to knock an arrow onto the bow, but I was shaking so badly at this point that I couldn't get the arrow knocked. And I was wondering if the mountain lion was going to pick up on this. It didn't, fortunately, and I did get the arrow knocked. I started to draw the mountain lion, but then I dropped the arrow on the ground. I thought for sure that was it was going to get me. But nothing happened still, so I picked up the arrow and put it back on the string, and I drew all the way, and this time I had a full draw, and I aimed at the mountain lion, hoping that I wouldn't have to shoot, and it just casually turned around and walked away.
Why do you think it turned away? Did it know that the bow and arrow was a weapon?
I think it did. You know, I don't know that. I suspect it did. I suspect it knew it was in danger at that point. It had a pointed object pointed at it, and it turned away.
Sounds like a very vivid memory.
It's very vivid, and what happened afterwards is I picked up my bag and my bow, and I ran up the hill about a half mile. In those days, I was a very fast runner. I could run a mile in 4:06, no problem. So I went up the hill, and I tripped over every single rock on that hill. And by the time I got to the road, I was bloodied and bruised. So that's something to keep in mind. Running, where I find the cause's results very intriguing. And if I was actually attacked, if the puma actually went after me, I suspect I'd probably run. It's probably a good idea. And it obviously prevents injury in some at least half the cases. But you have to be aware that if you're up, if your adrenaline's pumped up, you may not run as effectively or as efficiently as you would normally run. You could trip and give the wrong information to this big cat.
Sean Smallwood is an ecologist and a survivor of an encounter with a mountain lion, and Richard Koss, lead author of a recent study into how humans should respond when faced with a mountain lion. Did you know about Sean's encounter, and was that part of the data that you used for your study?
No, unfortunately, it was not included. And there are many examples where people just simply don't report it. We only use agency reports or anecdotes we had that we could look at, and really we trusted the data based upon the sort of information that was available. A lot of it were in the newspaper, so actually people could exaggerate material in that, but we did the best we could to sort of sort it out.
How do you respond to Sean's story? Because he says that back at that time, he was a very fast runner, and he chose not to run because he thought that the mountain lion took that as a cue to actually attack him.
I think that he just simply responded almost on an innate basis. We have this really urgent basis. I mean, people will run and climb trees dramatically. I mean, there's one case of one who climbed a tree, a mountain lion went after her, and she kicked the tree with her feet out of the tree itself. She was injured, but just an amazing thing. There's almost this automaticity where you just do an automatic behavior that's a very primitive one that comes from our primate ancestors, and that's climbing a tree if you can, or climbing at boulders, or you're trying to get yourself in a safe place, and we just don't think about it. There's no rationality there, but it's very carefully done in terms of the more primitive components.
Do we know what mountain lions think when they see a human? Do they see prey, or are they confusing us with some other kind of prey?
I don't think they see us as prey. I don't think there's been a long enough time for us to act as prey. Now, lions and leopards would see us as prey, but also we've had an adversarial relationship with both of those cats, so they would treat us very cautiously. Mountain lions what happens with repeated exposure to people, they become more relaxed, and then they could become more confident. And if they see some behaviors, like you're separated from a group while you're hiking, or you're hiking in some irregular way that makes you look disabled, or you're not very attentive, you're separated from the group, which is a very dangerous thing to be, then they might treat you, if they particularly have seen you before, in other words, seen humans repeatedly, they might treat you as potentially something to eat.
How would you personally respond, do you think, if you encountered a mountain lion in the wild?
I think if it's coming at a distance and I have some time to think about it, I would look around carefully. Can I move effectively? Is this a smooth road? Am I going to panic? I might back away facing the mountain lion, I think, in that case. It depends on the distance. If it's a sudden type of thing, I would just try to grab, like, for example, walking with a hiking stick is a good idea. Certainly, you can use it as a club if you need to. And, of course, you want to be with a group, probably walking around where you can turn around and watch your trail, both in front and behind, will help you plan escape routes as you're moving in hiking, so even before you see a mountain lion. So I think being aware of your environment as you're moving about in mountain lion country is very important.
What about making noise?
Yelling didn't seem to work. But certainly if you have a gun, shooting at the mountain lion, shooting the mountain lion, or making some sort of loud noise that could clearly startle a mountain lion seems to work.
And what if it attacks you with no notice and it's on you before you know it?
I think you're just going to have to use your arms and try to pull it off and do what you can. But it's, you know, they'll try to probably bite your head. They're not choking predators. I mean, they do choke, but they're not like leopards or lions where they'll grab your throat. They're trying to get your back and around your neck and area.
Sean Smallwood, your encounter with the mountain lion was a long time ago, but you're still an ecologist. Did that put you off being in trails, being in the wild?
It changed, it changed some of my behavior. I've learned a lot about mountain lions. Been doing my track count for mountain lions statewide. For example, I've associated the tracks I find with the vegetation and the topography conditions I survey. I found many more tracks in dense environments. We have riparian vegetation, for example, closed environments, box canyons. And in these kinds of places, I think you need to be more vigilant. I certainly am. When I'm in a riparian forest, a dense forest, close to water, or where you could be trapped by mountain lion, they have a lot of opportunity for ambushing prey, I'm much more cautious. I'll look behind me and make sure nothing's following me, because mountain lions oftentimes do follow people. They're curious, and they'll follow for long distances. I hear this from biologists all the time. I've been followed myself since that incident. It's pretty common, so it's a good idea to look around, be vigilant, and be ready. If you are pounced on, you should have some game plan that you can rely on right now, because you're not going to have much time.
Richard Koss, help put this into context. How likely is a human in California to encounter a mountain lion in the wild?
I would think extremely rare. I'm much more worried about a person on a cell phone and an SUV on my bicycle than I am about hiking, even alone. But I would definitely recommend hiking in groups and being vigilant and looking around as you're moving through the setting. So I'm not at all worried. In fact, yeah. There's something we have to think about. You know, this is a natural relationship with a predator in the environment. And it's kind of interesting to know that there's something out there. It makes it a little bit more exciting, even though the likelihood of encounter is extremely rare.
And finally, if encountering a mountain lion is unlikely, encountering a bigger predatory cat is even more unlikely, like a tiger or a leopard. But would this advice apply there, or are they just so big and powerful and fast that it's probably over?
I think it's ironic that actually being on the ground with lions, it might be a little bit fearful, but actually they back away. They're not interested in engaging people in groups, in part because there's probably been a million or more years of fairly adverse relationships of ancestral humans robbing kills and actually endangering these lions. Remember, we've had weapons for a long time.
Yes. Well, Richard Koss, psychology professor at UC Davis, is lead author of a recent study into how humans should respond when faced with a mountain lion. Bottom line is, you should consider running if you can run effectively and quickly and in a way that suggests that you're strong. Also, Sean Smallwood joined us. He's an ecologist, a survivor of an encounter with a mountain lion. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, you'll meet a Stockton man who's forming an armed militia. He's doing it because of upcoming layoffs in the police department. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, how the U.S. should deal with Pakistan, which is a refuge for members of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Plus, ideas for handling the many challenges facing Africa. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. A Stockton man says he's forming an armed militia that would patrol city streets if police officers are laid off this summer. The city of Stockton, like many, is dealing with budget problems and has announced dozens of police layoffs for July. The man who's organizing the militia is a retired truck driver and Vietnam War veteran. He's Alan Pettit. He joins us by phone. Alan Pettit, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
What actually gave you the idea? Was there one specific event or announcement from the city that prompted you to start to form a militia?
Well, what really prompted it was when the city announced, first off, the city of Stockton is supposed to have 660 police officers. At the present time, I believe we're right around 403, and they're talking of laying off 45 to 90 of these come July the 1st. Stockton is probably the highest per capita crime city in the state of California. And, you know, it just makes no sense at all. So I decided, well, I looked it up, and in the Constitution, according to the U.S. Constitution, we can form a militia. And what made this even more interesting was when we got a phone call from a judge in Sacramento who watched it on TV and that, who has decided that he will swear us in on the City Hall steps on July the 1st. I cut it off at 270 members because I was right in the middle still of tax season. And that's what I do is I do taxes now for a living, and this was in the middle of the April rush here, and I didn't have time to take any more phone calls. Since then, it's grown to almost 1,000 people that are interested in joining this militia.
You're saying that about 1,000 people have contacted you offering to serve on this armed militia that would patrol Stockton streets?
Yes.
Are these all people who live in Stockton?
Every single one of them so far is a Stockton resident.
How would you determine who would be a member of the militia, someone that would actually patrol the streets?
You know something? We really, you know, there's two or three of us that got really involved in this thing, and we're looking at it now. We're trying to screen all the gentlemen that have applied. We've also had 11 ladies, by the way, apply, and there's no particular race that's open to everybody, and we're finding that there's people of all walks, religions, and everything else that are interested in this. The reason that it really started was we can't afford to lay off these policemen. We need these policemen on the street. And we are going to be sworn in on July the 1st if they do not come to their senses in this city and stop this layoff mention of police officers. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, this city made a lot of mistakes like other cities did. They did not make any plans for a rainy day or that. I mean, you know, I run a very tight business of my own. I have no, you know, I kept money back for a rainy day. What's the matter with the city of Stockton? The problem with the city of Stockton and this mayor, by the way, is she sat on previous city councils as a council member. And she voted to go along with the developers when the developers were not paying their way. If the developers would have been made to pay their way like they have been in other cities, we wouldn't have this police shortage coming up. They wasted money on other things like Perigary's restaurant downtown, $2.5 million. Why should we get involved in private restaurants? I don't understand it. I never will understand it.
My guest is Alan Pettit. He's a Stockton man who says he's forming an armed militia that would patrol Stockton if the city lays off police officers this summer. But if the city just doesn't have, I mean, regardless of what the city has spent money on the past, if right now and next fiscal year it doesn't have enough money to maintain the police force at its current size, then what's the city supposed to do about that?
Well, the Constitution says that we can form a militia, and we will form a militia. We will be sworn in on the steps of City Hall, and if we have to run these tar and feather this bunch of politicians that aren't doing their job out of town, maybe that's what we need to do.
We contacted the Stockton Police Department for a comment on this, and Detective Roseanne Clark wrote us back. She started by acknowledging that citizens have long helped the police department with tips and witness reports of crimes, but she says an armed militia in the city raises several safety issues, and I'm going to read a couple of sentences from her email to us. Stockton police officers have several hundred hours of training prior to actually being placed in active duty. Our officers are tested and must pass rigid firearms qualifications with their duty weapon regularly, along with shotgun and M16 rifle. Detective Clark goes on, it is not known if the armed militia you're speaking of have legal rights to carry any type of handgun without proper licensing. There are several state laws which govern the carrying of a weapon. A violation of these laws can lead to arrest. Continuing, Lastly, if the armed militia were to become involved in an incident involving subjects with handguns, there's always the unfortunate possibility of the incident going awry, resulting in injury to themselves, innocent citizens, and potentially others. That's from an email from Stockton Police Department Detective Roseanne Clark, commenting on this issue. Well, Alan, let's go over her three main points. First of all, training. Police officers have hundreds of hours of training, including specific shotgun and handgun training. How do we know how well-trained and competent your militia members would be?
You know, I've picked veterans for specific reasons. We've had veterans from the very latest war, which is in Iraq and even Afghanistan. And they've both, the Marines that we've talked to that are interested in joining this group and that, have fought in urban warfare. And they were trained in urban warfare. I think they would do extremely well, probably better than what our Stockton PD is equipped to do.
But there's a big difference between being a Marine in Fallujah seeking Al-Qaeda terrorists and enforcing law and order on a city streets in California.
You really think it's that big a difference?
Well, I can't say for sure.
What about the four police officers that were just killed over in Oakland?
No.
Now, well, these were well-trained police officers, correct?
I'm sure they were.
And two of them were members of the SWAT team.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to Detective Clark's second issue, which is about the legal right to carry a handgun. For example, she cited the California Concealed Weapons Permit. What kind of... are the people in your militia, do they have the appropriate authority to carry weapons in the way that they would be if they were patrolling the city streets?
If they're sworn in by a federal judge and they are a militia is recognized by the U.S. Constitution. They can carry a gun. Who said we were going to carry it concealed? We don't have to carry it concealed.
She says that a violation of California's handgun laws could lead to arrest.
The federal law overrules California law.
Okay. And then the final point that Detective Clark raised was that if there was an incident involving militia members, armed militia members, and people on the streets, that there could be injury to the militia members, there could be injuries to innocent citizens. Let's just start with liability. Who would be responsible in that case?
A militia is formed for the protection of a city or a state or a county, whatever the case may be. And under the terms of the Constitution, the city of Stockton would be liable and responsible.
I've read that you would plan to bill the city for the militia services.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of a militia. A militia is always being paid. The last time one was formed here in the United States was 1861, by the way. And all militias must be paid. That's also part of the Constitution.
But if the city can't afford to keep police officers on the payroll, how would it be able to afford to pay the militia?
Gee, you know, that's their problem, isn't it? And you know what? Maybe if they keep the police officers on the payroll, we'll forget all about the militia. But if they don't, then the militia is going to be billing them at $300 per man per hour.
Would you actually be one of the militia members patrolling the streets?
No, I'm in a wheelchair. How am I going to get out there and patrol?
Yes. I'm sorry, I was not aware that you're in a wheelchair. Okay. Would you be in charge?
I'm not saying that I would be in charge. There's been several people that have come forward. We have a couple of attorneys and that have already showed a great deal of interest. And for legal information and that, you know, we certainly are going to need them.
And finally, Alan Pettit, have you talked about this plan specifically with either the police chief or the mayor or city officials?
I have talked to the police chief, and he doesn't want to see an armed militia out there. I can understand his controversy, but at the same time, we can't afford to have half the number of police officers out there on the streets that we've got.
Okay. Well, Alan Pettit, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Alan Pettit. He's a Stockton man who is working to form an armed militia that would patrol Stockton streets if the city lays off several dozen police officers this summer, as it plans to do. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the pianist who's playing a masterpiece by Grieg this weekend in Sacramento. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. Sacramento band Agent Ribbons has a new member and making waves in the music world, including a couple of recent showcases at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin. The band is back home, performing this weekend. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll talk about the new album and going on tour. They'll also play in our studio. Plus, Her Minor Thing, a feature film, a romantic comedy made in Sacramento a few years ago, finally about to get its US TV premiere. Grieg's Piano Concerto is one of the most popular pieces of its kind, and it's performed this Saturday in Sacramento. Pianist Richard Chonko will be on stage with the Camellia Symphony. Along with his performing and recording career, Chonko is also professor of piano at Sacramento State. Richard Chonko, welcome back to Insight.
Good to be back, Jeffrey. Thank you.
What's it like playing a great piano concerto on a stage with an orchestra?
Well, this particular piano concerto, as you said, is one of the most popular, and I've played it quite a few times, but it's always exhilarating. You have to kind of take a bit of a bold approach, especially when you play in the big halls. And Memorial Auditorium this Saturday is a pretty big hall.
It really is. It holds several thousand people, and it's more of a multi-purpose hall as opposed to, I don't know, like the main theater at the Mondavi Center, for example. Does that make a difference?
It does. The construction of the Memorial Auditorium is quite different from Mondavi, and consequently the acoustics are different. So we have to play around just a little bit with positioning ourselves, and in fact, to be quite frank, I'm going to have to play very loud.
Really?
In that space, yes.
What does it take to play very loud? Do you just have to apply more force to the keys, or is it something else?
Well, you can go over the brink if you apply too much force, and then you get an ugly sound. And at the university, I try to teach my students how far they can go through listening and through applying force, but without going over the breaking point. A good idea is to start with a good piano. And I'm going to have a 9-foot Steinway that's being donated for this concert by Mary Schnetz, who is a local Sacramentan, and she's a pianist. And I have played her piano. It's a wonderful Steinway. Well, so I think I'll be in good shape.
Well, I'm sure. But still, no matter how good the piano is, if it's a hall where you need to play louder than normal, but it's a quiet, sensitive passage, what do you do?
Right. Oh, that's a great question. You just have to beef up the quiet, sensitive passages just a little bit, because you have to understand that when you're far away from the piano, everything is relative. And when you're far away, it's going to sound quiet, even when you're playing a little bit louder. So you have to kind of, you have to listen, and you have to be very aware of the sound in the room.
Richard Chonko, the pianist, plays Grieg's Piano Concerto with the Camellia Symphony this Saturday evening at the Memorial Auditorium. In classical music, you have piano sonatas and piano concertos. The sonatas are solo pieces, but the concertos are played with an orchestra. What's the difference for the pianist between playing the sonata, the experience of playing the sonata, and the experience of playing the concerto with the whole orchestra?
Well, playing with an orchestra, you immediately become part of the ensemble. And you have helpers, and in fact, you're helping them. They're helping you. It's a collaborative effort, and frankly, you don't make all of the decisions by yourself. Maestro Alan Pollock is bringing his expertise and his musicianship to the piece as well, and so it's a collaborative effort. The players in the orchestra, by the way, are excellent. And there are many soloistic passages where they will get to show themselves off. In a solo sonata, it's all a union between you and the composer. And so it's basically just two people, you and the composer.
Grieg, Edvard Grieg, the composer, was Norwegian, and he only wrote one piano concerto. Do we know why he only wrote one? Because he otherwise wrote a lot of music.
Yeah, he sure did write a lot of music, and he wrote very well for the orchestra, and particularly the strings, I think. Although I have to say that, you know, the way he handles the brass and the woodwinds is absolutely ravishingly beautiful. I don't know why he only wrote one, but it was undoubtedly an immediate success, and you have to wonder why he didn't write another.
We don't have a recording of you playing Grieg's Piano Concerto, but we do have a couple of recordings of your work playing very different kinds of music, and we're going to listen to those. Let's start with an excerpt of a piece composed by Alberto Ginastera. This is from your 2003 album, Latin American Music for Solo Piano. We're going to listen to a portion of the Suite de Danzas Criollas. It's very beautiful music.
Yes, it is. Ginastera, I think, is the greatest South American composer.
Yes. That is, you've got to be in a very different space playing that as opposed to a big piano concerto with an orchestra.
Yeah, that particular piece is quite intimate. And, it requires, triple pianissimo and very delicate touch.
Another piece that we have that features you is from a slightly earlier album. It's called La Commedia, Harlequin Ghosts and Fantasies. And the composer Daniel Kingman, here's part of the piece Harlequin Dances. To many people's ears, this sounds very typically modern classical music. How do you suggest people listen to music like this, which is very different from the quote-unquote war horses of classical music?
Yeah, well, this particular set of pieces called La Commedia is a set of character pieces, so it comes from the Schumann vein, really. It comes from the 19th century. But it's spoken in a modern language. The composer, Daniel Kingman, was a professor at the university here, and, knowing him, and he was a very charming, intelligent man, and it seemed like a good fit that I would want to play his music. I think that one has to be open when one listens to any music, whether it be pop music or classical music. And if you're not ready to hear it, well, then listen to it later.
Yes. How important is the melody in music like that? It seems to me that there's less of an emphasis on the melody and more of an emphasis on the overall feeling of the music.
Yeah, the overall character, in fact. Yes. You're exactly right. Music has gone through several transformations, I suppose, and more than that, even over the last few hundred years, being harmony-driven and then being melody-driven and then coming back to just being mood music. And there are so many different types of music in the world that, it's sometimes hard to know how to listen. But in this case, you just try to be open to it and get what you can from it, and maybe listen to it a few times, come to it when you're relaxed.
Pianist Richard Chanko, this weekend you're playing one of the great romantic piano concertos, but these recordings, they're 20th century composers. Is that more where you're at personally?
Well, I like to think I play a little bit of everything. I love to play Bach, and last year I was playing all Beethoven for my solo recital season. I play the Liszt piano concertos, and it's just, I think, maybe a coincidence that two of my recent recordings were of music of the 20th century. I have a Beethoven CD in the pipeline, and I have another CD in the pipeline, which is actually 21st century music. So we'll wait and see on that. But I like to play a variety of music, just like I like to eat a variety of foods.
What is it, do you think, about Bach's piano music that makes it so timeless? Because it seems that 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 piano music works for so many people, regardless of their other musical tastes.
It does. It can adapt well. I have a friend who sometimes says, when great music is really great, you can't hurt it.
You also teach, along with performing, recording. You're professor of piano at Sacramento State. You've also taught at Juilliard. Does that take a different part of your brain?
It does, yeah. Pianists have to wear many hats, I like to tell my students. And, the performing aspect of my life is quite different from the teaching aspect of my life. The teaching aspect is a little bit more regimented on a daily basis, whereas the practicing that I do, which, by the way, is on a daily basis as well, somehow taps into a different creative side. But it's an interesting life to juggle, yeah.
You've played piano in many countries. You played with many orchestras. You played in some very prestigious venues. How does the pianist in you reconcile that with what must sometimes be the frustrations of teaching piano to people of varying abilities?
Well, yeah, it's always interesting to hear young people who are interested in piano or in classical music or in music in general. Recently, I was in Hong Kong for 3 weeks, and I heard 2,000 pianists play individually in 3 weeks, and I wrote comments for every single one of them. And it, in some ways, it warms the heart because you realize that there are young people who are interested and willing and will eventually someday assume their role in music.
What is it about Juilliard that makes it so great?
Well, Juilliard, it's a very particular kind of place, obviously, a conservatory with a great tradition. I heard recently, in fact, I heard yesterday that it has become the choosiest school, overtaking even Harvard. They only allow in 4% of applicants now.
Wow.
And so it's a tight place.
And presumably the applicants, for the most part, are at a pretty high level anyway, because if you're not pretty good already, you probably wouldn't bother applying to Juilliard.
I think you can say that for sure. I think what really makes Juilliard the great school that it is two factors. One, the faculty is terrific. And two, the opportunities that are around the Juilliard student all the time are just...
By being in New York?
By being in New York and also by being at the school, the opportunities such as, somebody like Domingo coming to give a master class or Yo-Yo Ma coming to give a performance and a talk to the students. Ashkenazi visited our class one day, you know. I'm just from week to week, you never quite know who's going to show up, and it's really exciting.
I can imagine. Richard Chonko, pianist. He plays Grieg's Piano Concerto with the Camellia Symphony this Saturday evening. It starts at 8 at Sacramento's Memorial Auditorium. There are other romantic pieces on the program. Richard Chonko, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, more sound advice. This week, alternative rock. Off-air host Nick Bruner has new releases to check out. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous Insight, it's okay. Check out our archives at capradio.org/insight. Each Thursday, we bring you sound advice, tips on music you might want to check out. This week, Nick Bruner, host of Capital Public Radio's online-only new music show, Off Air. Its web address gives you a good idea of the kind of music featured, smartrockradio.org. Nick Bruner, welcome back to Insight.
Oh, hello, Jeffrey. Let me just go on record as saying that I want to join the throngs of people to say I love your show.
Well, thank you so much.
Indeed.
Now, Off Air comes out a new show every Wednesday night, so the new show is just out.
Yes, actually, it posts this second it turns into Thursday. I don't know why we decided that. We just said midnight on Thursday, and then explaining that to people has been, well, is that midnight Wednesday? Is it Friday morning? It's the second it turns Thursday, so...
Okay.
We just like to say every new Thursday.
Do you get a lot of CDs and audio files sent to you?
Yeah, actually, it's been great. We've getting anywhere between about 15 and 30 records a week to audition.
Wow, that's a lot to keep up with.
Yeah. Actually, we just brought on a volunteer from the Capitol, from the KSSU student station at Sacramento State. She's been a big help. And yeah, a lot to wade through. Sometimes it's, you know, pretty obvious when something's going to work. Other times things have to grow on you. It's like, you know, listening to a record at home or hearing a song on the radio. You're either going to like it or it's going to warm on you. And it takes about a week to figure that out.
Well, you've got four records with you today. What are we going to start with?
Well, let's start with a group. Off Air likes to really get into the new stuff. But this time around, we're looking into a reissue to start off the show. It's by the Vaselines, who were most active in the late 80s and the early 90s. And they'd fit in really well right now. Their sound is held up very well in terms of what's going on in pop music these days. Sub Pop Records in Seattle, they're re-releasing just about everything from the Scottish duo they recorded. It's likely that that has something to do with the influence that they've had on lots of different artists, including a young man named Kurt Cobain. Back in 1994, for example, he covered the Vaselines with Nirvana on their 1994 MTV Unplugged record.
That was Nirvana Unplugged, leading into the Vaselines, who originally did the song. What is this? Is this a Vaselines album, or is it a compilation of some of the best stuff?
It's a compilation of pretty much everything they've done. It's two EPs and their one LP on one disc. And then the second disc is three songs from one of their demos, and then a big chunk of live tracks from Bristol and live in London between 1986 and 1988.
Got to laugh about the title of the record, Enter the Vaselines.
Yes, actually, that's the name of one of the EP that they were re-releasing. So
that's a reissue on the Sub Pop label. What's the second track you have for us?
Well, another band from Glasgow, Scotland, actually, but this one's has been active a little bit more in the last couple of years. This is Camera Obscura. They just released their album on 4AD called My Maudlin Career.
And that's a great title.
The song's called French Navy. Spent a week in a dusty library, waiting for some words to jump in me. We met by a trick of fate, French Navy, my sailor maid.
It's kind of sardonic, but if you didn't listen to the words, it would just sound like very simple pop music from the 60s.
Oh, it certainly is. Actually, I was thinking just the same thing, that it harkens back to doo-wop groups from the U.S. And I just found out, really, I mean about 5 minutes before I set foot in here, that the producer, Jen Picard, had said that Camera Obscura is going to be the Sacramento band Agent Ribbons is touring with on their upcoming tour.
And we'll be talking about that tomorrow with Agent Ribbons on Insight.
We call that a forward promote in the radio industry.
Yes. Very nice. So that's Camera Obscura. What's the third record you have for us today?
Third record is actually something that we revisited on Off Air this time. It's no hint to here. It's our Fun Drive show on Off Air this coming week. And this is one of the tracks that we played on our very first episode. It's one that's really a lot of fun. It's by a man named Daedalus, and it's a cut called Fair Weather Friends.
Thank you.
Wow, that's great. It's sort of hypnotic but crazy.
It really is. It's very dancey, and this album has been described. It came out in June of 2008, which is, you know, one of the reasons that it's not really new, but it's one of our, hey, best of off-air kind of cuts.
What do you like about it?
I like the fact that it's such a happy kind of sound, and yet at the same time, if you really listen to, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but there's something kind of melancholic about that song. I love when it mixes the sort of like really happy kind of vocals with sort of a kind of a down melody.
So this song has made its return to Off Air because it's your Fun Drive special, and so you like to...
Right, we're sort of talking about our favorite stuff since the show's been on. I mean, we've only been doing this about 16 weeks now, all the way through, but at the same time, yeah, we can have a best of.
My guest is Nick Bruner, host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online-only music show at smartrockradio.org. This is Sound Advice. It's our weekly Thursday feature on Insight, where we talk about new music of all kinds, reissues included. What's the fourth track you have for us?
Last one is by a Sacramento band called Buildings Breeding. We first introduced them to the off-air lineup last week. We did a feature on a local coffee shop and all-ages venue in Sacramento called the Java Lounge, and this is one of the local bands that performs on their stage. This cut's called Bee Sting.
Very nice. Is this just one track that's available, or do they have a whole record out, whole album?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Coming out in 1 month, Buildings Breeding is going to be having their record release party, actually on May the 23rd. Today's April 23rd. May 23rd at Old Ironsides. You can find all their details at their MySpace page.
Is that song typical of what they do?
Yes, actually, I'd say it's very typical of what they do. You know, I guess you don't want to pigeonhole into one sort of sound, but that's a very nice representation of what they have available to listen to online.
Well, finally, Nick, driving to and from work the last day or so, I've been enjoying listening to the latest album by the Handsome Furs.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's actually going to be our off-air's very first Fun Drive thank you gift. And we'll be hearing a lot about that over the next week, I'm sure. But the album's called Face Control, and it's another one of those records that really sums up what Off-Air tries to do. And we're thrilled that, you know, we've only been, like I said, on for about 4 months now. And, you know, we happen to have a, you know, way to say thanks for everybody who listens.
Yeah, it's really interesting music. There's a lot in their musical DNA. You know, they've got this sort of old school synth instruments, but they've got this rock guitar and just all sorts of things going on. They're from Canada, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And they actually had to, one of their songs, they sampled a little bit of a New Order track.
Yeah.
And they thought it was going to go through just all kinds of, you know, just bureaucratic hell trying to get that song passed so they could release it on the record. Apparently New Order heard it and turned it around and said, yes, please, go ahead and put this out. We love your record. Go for it. And I guess they just don't do that.
Yeah, well, it sounded almost like New Order sort of passed along some of their old drum machines and so on, because there's that sort of sound to it. It's really interesting. But the addition of the guitar, it just takes the music in another direction. Well, Nick Bruner, thank you so much for joining us on Sound Advice.
Happy to do it.
Okay, that's Nick Bruner, host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online-only music show at smartrockradio.org. Next Thursday on Sound Advice, longtime radio DJ, Capital Public Radio jazz host, and Sacramento rock history archivist Dennis Newhall. Music he'll bring includes tracks from Bob Dylan's upcoming album, Together Through Life. It's Dylan's 46th record, and it's released next Tuesday. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on our guests and topics, go to capradio.org/insight. Insight's theme composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Nathan Wilkinson and Lynn Weaver. Our technical director, Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. And thank you for joining us. Sacramento band Agent Ribbons is a new member and is making waves in the music world, including a couple of recent showcases at the South by Southwest Festival. The band is back home and performing this weekend. On the next Insight, we'll talk about their new album and going on tour, and the band will perform in our studio. Plus, Her Minor Thing, a feature film made in Sacramento, about to get its US TV premiere. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.